We talk a lot about magic in our world, but not really in a serious sense. You know, the magic of love or the magic that music plays in our souls. Our ancestors took magic a whole lot more seriously. Human history is full of belief in the supernatural, with a lot of documents to give us a look into those beliefs. Our guest this hour laid his hands on texts going back thousands of years and brought them together into a new volume called The Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment. Brian Copenhaver is a professor of philosophy and history at UCLA. He studies philosophy and science in late medieval and early modern Europe and is a charter co-editor of the journal Magic, Ritual, and Witchcraft. He's the author of a dozen other completed books and the editor of this one. Brian Copenhaver, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
You're very welcome. Very good to be with you.
I underscore that you are the editor, not the creator. Where did they all come from, all these things you brought together here?
Well, they came from a lot of different places. I translated most of them, but these are all original texts. They come from, for example, the Hebrew Bible. They come from the Christian New Testament, which was originally written in Greek. There are a few Persian documents, which I couldn't translate because I can't read Persian. and then they come from ancient Greek and Roman sources like Homer and Virgil, and then they come from medieval sources, early medieval sources, and also later medieval sources. And in those cases, those are written by some of the most famous Christian writers, like Saint Augustine or Saint Thomas Aquinas. And then in the Renaissance, by people like Marsilio Ficino and Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, who were the most famous thinkers active in Renaissance Florence. And then finally, in the 17th century, figures like John Milton and Shakespeare and Ben Jonson, and last of all, the very famous philosopher Leibniz.
This is an exhaustive look. I mean, it's a very big book, but still manages to stay under 600 pages or so. I'm really impressed, though. You did the translation yourself from the Greek and the Latin?
That's right.
Wow. How long a project has this been?
Well, it depends on how you ask the question. I mean, I've been working on the material in the book since about 1966, so it's been a very long time in that sense. This particular book, putting this one together, started about 3 years ago when Penguin and I began to talk about the project.
Is it fair to say that belief in magic is threaded throughout human history?
Oh, very much so. The tricky thing is what's meant by the word magic. Some people take it to be something that's universal to all human beings, in the way that all human beings walk, or all human beings breathe, or all human beings eat. That's not something that that I think is correct. I think that what we actually call magic is something that was constructed by human beings, first of all, in the ancient Greek and Roman worlds, from the time of Homer, let's say, to the time of the time of Virgil, covering about 1,000 years, but then eventually, that thing that got invented by the ancient Greeks was taken over by other people who became Christian after the time that the New Testament was written in late antiquity. And what we now call magic is, I think, a construct of that specifically Christian way of looking at the issues involved. So when anthropologists who study magic very, very carefully and very exactly, when they travel around the world and they see people doing things and believing things and they call that magic, in my view, what they're doing is they're importing a Christian concept into cultural situations which may or may not be properly described as Christian.
So it begs the question then whether magic is often there in companion with religion through history, in opposition to religion, a mixture of both?
That's correct. One of the most famous and still very, very powerful ways of looking at it, one that it comes up very often unconsciously in conversation, was invented by a very famous person named Fraser in the late 19th century, and who wrote a very famous book called The Golden Bough. And in that book, what he did was to make the claim that the most primitive layers of human belief are magical, and then those evolve in an evolutionary way into religion, and then those in turn evolve into science, so that there's a progressive line of development in human culture from magic through religion to science. So in that sense, in an evolutionary way, according to Fraser, magic is opposed, certainly distinct from, and in many ways opposed to, both religion and science. And that's how it's often seen. Fraser was a very, very smart guy and very learned and read an enormous amount of material about this. Nonetheless, the basic idea is a little problematic, because if magic is something that's distinctly primitive, then it's a little hard to understand how very, very, very famous and learned philosophers like Plotinus and Proclus in the ancient Greek world, or like Thomas Aquinas and Albertus Magnus in the medieval world, and like Ficino in the Renaissance, how they could have been believers of magic if it was something distinctly primitive.
Wow, a lot to latch onto here, much more to talk about with Brian Copenhaver about the Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest this hour is Brian Copenhaver, professor of philosophy and history at UCLA, and the creator as editor of a grand new book called The Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment, helping us understand the many ways in which we viewed magic throughout human history, or at least through recorded human history. Centuries of stuff to talk about here. And you can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Brian, just to make sure people understand, this is a work of reference, not a book of spells or a magical cookbook or anything like that.
That's right. That's right. It's a place where you can go if you want to learn something about how people understood magic as it developed in Western culture over the last few thousand years. So it covers a very, very broad expanse of time, and it introduces people to texts, some of which are maybe quite familiar, like texts from the Hebrew Bible and the Greek New Testament, but some are less familiar. And some of those do actually contain descriptions of or accounts of spells, because the use of spells obviously is a big part of magic. So a book about magic kind of has to recognize that, right? But the main thrust of the book is to answer some questions, like the one you just asked: what's the relationship of magic to religion and science? But another question that it aims to answer is why is the reputation, the respectability of magic so different now in the modern world, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, than it was just a few hundred years ago? So this person that I've mentioned a couple of times, Marsilio Ficino, who developed the first really effective theory of magic in the early modern world. He was a very, very prominent philosopher in Renaissance Italy. In fact, he was the first person who translated all of the works of Plato into a language that people could read, from Greek into Latin, a language that people could read in Western Europe when not many of them could read Greek. So he was a very, very distinguished person and enormously respected in his culture. And yet, It was that person, Ficino, who developed the most powerful and most effective theory of magic in modern times and published it in 1489. So the puzzle is, why was Ficino a completely respectable person who did that and did it quite publicly around the year 1500? And then if you fast forward by a couple of centuries and you look at the period of Isaac Newton, who's obviously a very famous physicist and mathematician, it's been well known for more than 75 years now that Newton spent a great deal of his career working on alchemy.
Mm-hmm. Trying to turn lead into gold and that sort of thing?
That sort of thing. That's exactly right. But it was he, of course, who invented a lot of modern mathematics and a modern physics. Well, when he did that, the people who surrounded him and who had enormous respect for him when he died weren't anxious for it to be known that he was interested in alchemy. And they kind of suppressed it, and it didn't really get discovered until around 1945, a long time later. So evidently, what had happened in this over this period of two centuries was that something that had been quite reputable and quite respectable when Marsilio Ficino was living in Florence in the Renaissance in the late 15th century, a couple of hundred years later, around the time that Newton died in 1727, it was not respectable at all. If you wanted to be thrown out of the club of Europe's leading intellectuals, then one way to do it by 1727 would be to let people know that you were seriously interested in magic, whether you were promoting it or even working to refute it. It simply fell off the table as something that serious intellectuals were interested in by the early 18th century.
Is this largely because, I mean, we're talking the age of the Enlightenment, which produced the likes of Thomas Jefferson, who was sort of nominally religious. I mean, as religion fell away, did magic fall with it?
No. For example, during the same time that magic was declining in the 17th century in England, persecutions of witchcraft reached a very, very high peak in the 1640s in England, and I think the last witch who was executed in the British Isles was executed in the early 18th century, around the time that Newton died. So some of the worst aspects, some of the most dangerous aspects of belief in magic still survived among a lot of people, but it was pretty universal that all of these people were devout believers in religion of one kind or another. There were, of course, people in the 18th century in the Enlightenment who were severe critics of religion, people like Voltaire, for example. But they were pretty exceptional. And it's not that people in general were becoming less religious. However, because of people like John Locke, who very much influenced Thomas Jefferson, and whose ideas about religion included the notion that religion ought to be rational, no doubt those ideas did cause certain changes in religion. But to think that religion somehow became less powerful, I mean, all you have to do is to look at the course of religion through the 18th and the 19th and the 20th, or even in our own time, the 21st century, religions remain a very, very powerful thing. So magic didn't collapse because religion did, because religion didn't collapse. Rather, what happened that among people like John Locke or Isaac Newton or Leibniz, people who were prominent intellectuals and creators of intellectual works in the 17th century. Among those people, what happened is that the foundations for belief in magic eroded. The surprising thing, I think, for a lot of people would be to learn that the foundations for belief in magic were in fact philosophical, and that they were actually some fairly sophisticated philosophical theories initially developed in a long time ago in antiquity by Aristotle. Those ideas had remained dominant since Aristotle's time for almost 2,000 years, exactly during the time when the construct of magic developed in the West. And it was only in the 17th century that there was really an effective challenge to Aristotle's dominance of philosophical thinking. And it was that change, really, that caused, again, people like Locke and Newton and Leibniz and Galileo and Descartes and Hobbes. That's what caused those people to lose their confidence in magic, because they could no longer see any basis for it in rational philosophy. That's what bothered them.
Brian Copenhaver is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of philosophy and history at UCLA, and the compiler of The Book of Magic. He's the editor of it, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment, a real look at magical texts or texts dealing with magic through history. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, for your thoughts about magic and religion and their pairing or not through history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The texts begin with the Old Testament, Exodus 7, and I'm really struck. I get the sense from the analysis here that essentially if I do it, it's God. If you do it, it's magic.
There's a lot to be said for that. I think that's in many ways a good way to begin to understand the situation. I think that a reasonable way to think about magic is that magic is somebody else's religious behavior. When that behavior becomes illicit or wrong or not permitted or illegitimate in somebody else's eyes, so that, you know, for example, if there's this very interesting story in the Old Testament, which a lot of people know, in the book of Samuel, which is about a character called the Witch of Endor. Mm-hmm. It's a female character. We're never given her name. She's just the woman who lives in a certain place called Endor. And what happens is that she is asked by the king of Israel at the time, whose name is Saul,
yeah.
Right? She's asked by Saul to help him make contact with one of his important advisors, a prophet named Samuel, who had died. And so she does, and what she does is she calls Samuel up from the grave. Samuel appears and actually does provide important information. Doesn't do Saul much good in the end, because he's very near his final ruin. But the actual act of raising somebody from the grave to speak to a king, it works. So in this and many other cases, you see things being done, and this is true both in the Hebrew Bible and in the Greek New Testament. You see many things being done which would, I think, answer to most people's description of what magic is. But in some cases, they're legitimate. They're not only authorized by important figures like the king of Israel, or in this case, the prophet Samuel was involved. But they're positively required in order to see to it that the will of God gets done. So in the first really famous story of this kind in the Hebrew Bible, what happens is that there's a wonder working contest, and Moses and his brother Aaron are appearing before Pharaoh, and they're trying to convince Pharaoh, as the famous saying goes, to let my people go. But as that's going on, what they do is they get into a kind of magic duel with Pharaoh's magicians. And they have their magical wands, they hold them in their hands, and the Pharaoh's magicians have their magical wands, which they're able to turn into snakes. And ultimately, what happens is that the power that Moses and Aaron are given by God works better than the power that Pharaoh's magicians have. But it's not that Pharaoh's magicians don't have any power at all. They do. It's just that Moses' power and Aaron's power is stronger, right? So what's going on there? What's religious about that scene, and what's magical about it? It's also hard to know what exactly to call the people who are doing this, because if you read various translations of the Hebrew Bible, you'll find these people who were working for Pharaoh. You'll sometimes find them called magicians, and sometimes you'll find them called sorcerers.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, those are words which don't exist in Hebrew, right? The Hebrew words are mekashvim and hartumim. And when we translate those as magician or sorcerer, what we're doing is we're using language which was developed much later and which is tied to a wide array of concepts which didn't exist at the time. So when we classify something as religious rather than magical, or magical rather than religious, in a situation like this, it's really very difficult to make the distinctions.
Is it possible too that they were referred to by the Pharaoh as priests?
Yes, of course it is. But again, we'd have the same problem, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Because, right? I mean, that's also something. What counts as a priest in Pharaoh's court at the time of Moses, versus what counts as a priest in, let's say, the city of Rome in the year 2016. Functionally, what does a priest do now? Functionally, what did a priest do for Pharaoh? So those are the questions you have to ask. And one of the points of the book is to let people read the original texts where these distinctions got worked out hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Our guest is Brian Copenhaver. He is the editor of the Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment. Magic obviously gets tied up with the devil, particularly as we move into the New Testament. Satan by name, when did that first appear in the Bible?
Well, when you read about Satan in the Bible, and again, it's going to depend on what translation you're reading. When the word Shatan originally appears in the Bible, what it means is an adversary. So in the book of Job, when the book of Job opens, there's this very famous scene between the Lord the adversary Shatan comes along and has this conversation with the Lord, and the Lord says, "Where have you been?" And Job says, "I've been roaming about the earth." And they start talking about this person whom the Lord calls my servant Job. Then what starts is a kind of contest, really, between God and the adversary, Shatan, to see if Shatan can test Job and tempt him to denounce the Lord, and then the action of the book unfolds after that. Well, the word Shatan in that case means something like the opponent or the adversary, and it's the more or less the sort of thing you would think of in a court of law, when one attorney would be the adversary of the other attorney in a court. But it's not yet a proper name. It's not yet Satan. That doesn't begin to happen until other parts of the Bible, where, for example, in the first book of Chronicles, when there's this very, very short passage where somebody is influencing King David in a negative way. Somebody's making King David do something bad. And strangely enough, the bad thing that King David is doing is he's conducting a census. He's counting the number of people in his kingdom. And you might think, well, that's a pretty normal thing for a king to do,
mm-hmm.
right? But what it does, of course, is it increases the king's power. And from the point of view of some of the voices that you hear in the Hebrew Bible, increasing the king's power isn't necessarily a good thing from the point of view of prophets who are critics of the king. So in this particular case, in the book of Chronicles, it's Satan who incites David, King David, to count the people, to number the people, to conduct a sentence. And when that happens, it looks as if the name's being used as a proper name.
Interesting.
By that point, we've got Satan as we know him. I won't say as we've come to know and love him, because we don't love him.
Not a whole lot. Now, the Book of Magic from Antiquity to the Enlightenment is our discussion topic on The Exchange today with its editor, Brian Copenhaver, who has worked for a very long time on this, as you heard at the top. We'll come back and talk more with Brian and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Brian Copenhaver. He's a professor of philosophy and history at UCLA, and he has compiled a really exhaustive book on magic through history called The Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment. A look at texts including the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, ancient Greek and Roman texts, and a whole lot more up until magic began to wear off on the human race. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments or interpretations of your own. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's move into the New Testament, and Monty from Roseburg helps us out there. He asks if you're familiar with the book Jesus the Magician by Morton Smith.
Very much, yes. I think it's one of the most important books written in recent times about the development of magic.
Which then raises the question about, I mean, the things that Jesus and the disciples are considered to have done would have been considered witchcraft in some circles, but was holiness in theirs.
Correct. I'm not sure witchcraft is quite the right word for it, but the sense of what your caller is saying is correct. So, for example, there's a famous story which is very short. So maybe I can
sure.
I can actually just read you a piece of it in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus is in a certain place called Bethany. And he's hungry. So the next day when they left Bethany, that means Jesus and the apostles left Bethany, he was hungry. Seeing a fig tree in leaf at some distance, he went to see if there was anything on it. When he got to it, he found nothing but leaves, since figs were not in season. And then he spoke to the tree, saying, quote, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again," unquote. And his students heard him. Going into Jerusalem, they went to the temple, where he began throwing the sellers and buyers out. And then there's another story that kind of breaks into this one. And then a little later, as they went on their way in the morning, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. Peter remembered and said to him, "Look, teacher, the fig tree that you cursed has dried up." And Jesus answered, telling them to, quote, "Have confidence in God. Truly, I tell you, that if anyone says to this mountain, 'Get up and throw himself into the sea,' with no doubt in his heart, but believing that what he says will happen, it shall be so for him. So I say to you all things that you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received them," and so on. So it's you would think it would be a story about the power of prayer, and most people would think of prayer as sort of an essential religious act. On the other hand, what happens in the story is that Jesus is hungry, he sees a fig tree, he curses the fig tree, and of course the curse is just the opposite of a prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
A curse is kind of a negative prayer, and then as a result of the cursing, what happens if the fig tree shrivels up? Now, what's the poor fig tree done, right? All the fig tree is doing what fig trees do when it's not the right season. The fig tree isn't bearing figs. And it's for that reason, we're told, that the fig tree gets cursed. So there's a curse which has a very, very negative effect in the natural world. And in many circumstances, if somebody observed that, and having the vocabulary of the English language at one's disposal, that person say, well, what happened there is this person put a magical curse on the tree, and the tree shriveled up and died. But in this case, the figure who's doing it is Jesus Christ, And that rather changes the bidding, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does.
Yeah.
So the overall, and let me even go back to the very beginning, because you've traced, you're so good at translating these languages from the original, the actual etymology of magic itself. I mean, what does it trace back to?
The Greeks and the Persians, the people who came from the part of the world we now call Iran, they were each other's worst enemies, say around the year about 500 before the Common Era. The Greeks and the Persians fought a great war, and eventually the Greeks won in the sense that they drove out Persian invaders. But it was not an easy war to win. It was very, very difficult. And naturally, in the course of that conflict, the Greeks developed very, very strongly negative feelings about the invaders. Well, there were a group of Persians who came from a particular place, and that particular tribe of Persians were called by a Persian name, which the Greeks translated into their own language, Greek, as Magoi. So a group of these people in the plural would be called Magoi. In the singular, one of them would be called a Magos. And then the thing that a Magos did was called Mageia. This particular group of Persians seemed to have had some particularly religious tasks. And eventually the Greeks came to use the word mageia for religious behavior of which they didn't approve, particularly when it came from that part of the world. So that's what eventually mageia came to mean. And then eventually the Romans borrowed that Greek word. They began to use it actually much later in the first century before the Common Era. And became the Latin word magia, and that eventually became the French word magie, which became the English word magic. But it started off as a negative term, right, a pejorative term, which the Greeks used to describe bad things that their Persian enemies did. And then eventually, when the Latin world got Christianized in the first and second and third centuries of the Common Era, very, very powerful Western European intellectuals like St. Augustine wrote descriptions of magia, spelled M-A-G-I-A, which they took to be this really, really bad behavior, which was bad because it violated certain kinds of religious prohibitions. The most important of these prohibitions was this, that in the whole universe, from Augustine's point of view, there were only the following kinds of persons. God, from Augustine's point of view, was a person. You and I, human beings, are persons. Angels are persons. And demons are persons. And Satan, of course, would be the chief demon.
Mm-hmm.
God was completely in charge of which of those persons you could have conversations with, except in the case of human beings. You could talk to any human beings you wanted to, but talking to angels, demons, and God, there you had to be careful. And the worst kind of magic, from Augustine's point of view, would get you into conversations with demons, and eventually those conversations would become transactions. The demons would offer to do things for you, and then once you agreed to those transactions, then you'd become subject to the demon's power, and then your soul would be lost.
Okay, so that begins with the whole idea of the devil capturing your soul and the general trickery that seems to revolve around the concept of magic coming from the dark
side.
Yeah,
right.
In fact, the black magic, you bring this up, that in early Christian Europe we get the terms necromantia and negromantia. Is it possible we got the idea of black magic just through bad pronunciation?
Yeah, I'm not really sure where the about the whole story on black magic. It's something I should do some more work on. But it basically goes like this: that the sort of thing that was going on in the Witch of Endor story, where the the person, the woman called the witch avenger, raises a dead person from the grave. That's what the Greek word necromanteia means. The first part of the word, the N-E-K-R part, means
the dead part.
Dead, and then the last part of it, manteia, means divination with the dead. So it's using the dead to give you information which you can't otherwise have in a natural way. The information might be, for example, knowing about the future. That's what usually what divination is. But it wouldn't have to be that. It could be just you could knowing something was happening far away or something had happened long ago. It's just unusual information and maybe even illicit information. So that's what necromanteia originally meant. It was using the dead to do divination, to acquire information in a certain way. Then what happened is that in the Middle Ages, that word got used, that Greek word got used by people whose native language wasn't, whose functional language wasn't Greek, rather it was Latin, and it got sort of mutated into nigromantia in Latin, N-I-G-R-O. The Latin word N-I-G-E-R means black. And eventually people began to talk about black magic. Now the first time I'm sure when it was used was in the late 16th century by Spencer, the famous English poet. I don't really know what he meant by it in that circumstance. Usually when people use it now, what they mean by it is magic that's bad. But isn't from some points of view, for example, from some Christian points of view, I think all magic is supposed to be bad. So in that case, what would be the difference between the black magic and the other kind? And if it is bad, why does it have to be black? Why couldn't it be green? You know, so so I think that's the etymology of the word tells you something about that story.
Is it too fine a point to say that Magia, which became magic, just refers to pagan rites or the rites of a religion that is beneath ours?
No, I don't think it's quite like that. I was talking to somebody about this a few weeks ago, and in a very acute way, she used a phrase that Sigmund Freud had used to talk about some problems he was interested in, called the narcissism of small differences. what's meant by that is that if you and I are going to get mad at one another, really mad, then probably we need to have something mutually at stake. Mm-hmm. And if, for example, we're both Christians, right, then one thing we might have mutually at stake is our Christian beliefs. Or if we're Jews, one thing we might have mutually at stake is our Jewish beliefs, and so on and so forth. Well, if you've got a couple of people who are both in, broadly speaking, the same religious circumstance, in that they would both self-identify as Christians or Jews or Muslims, but one of them, from the other's point of view, is deviant, right? Either does things in a religious way which aren't properly religious, or believes things in a religious way that aren't properly religious, then that becomes something that you need a negative word for, a pejorative word for. And in the Western European tradition, one of the developments of that is that people who thought of themselves as completely upright and righteous in a religious sense would denounce other people for behavior which broadly might actually look religious, but from the point of view of the denouncing person, of the accusing person, wasn't properly religious. It wasn't doing it exactly right. And the distinctions might be fairly fine distinctions, because in those cases, both parties who disagree with one another have a lot at stake because their belief systems are fundamentally the same.
We got about a minute left here, and I just wanted to ask Brian, there's an intro to The Fall of Simon Magus that references a stage magician, and I wonder when we first began to see that as opposed to magic tied so closely to religion.
You see it in the case of Simon Magus, but you also see it in a contemporary figure who's described in the book. He's called Apollonius of Tyana, he's sometimes described as a wise person, a philosopher, a sage, but he's also described sometimes as a kind of faker. And in particular, his enemies described him that way. So that one of the ways that this, in general, this kind of behavior could go wrong, right? It could go wrong by being fake. And the idea of fake religion gets to be part of the Christian vocabulary for what gets denounced as magic because it's fake. Now that's not the only way of going bad, right? You could also go bad by getting yourself on Satan's side, which is definitely the wrong team to play for.
All right, it's an exhaustive work called The Book of Magic, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment. Brian Copenhaver is the editor of it, professor of philosophy and history at UCLA. Thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Jeff, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
A pleasure.